Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. You're listening to the Voice of Pancreatic Cancer podcast. I'm your host, Miranda Weinberg with the Sina Magowitz Foundation. And if you don't know about the Sina Magowitz Foundation, we are a nonprofit that's committed to the awareness, prevention, and cure of pancreatic cancer. I'm excited today to welcome Dr. Ben George from the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. George, thank you for being here with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And before we jump in to today's topic, I just want to take a quick moment to say thank you to our sponsors. Without you guys, we wouldn't be able to do the important work that we do, which is funding clinical trials. And that's actually what we're going to be talking about today. Dr. George, besides being a medical oncologist, a very busy one, you also are the head of the clinical trial office. So why don't you tell our listeners today just a little bit about your background and how you got to be where you are?
Sure. Yeah, great question. So I'm a GI medical oncologist, and my clinical and research focus for the past decade has been in the pancreas cancer arena. But a lot of the work that we have done, along with seeing and treating patients, is also advancing clinical trials in this disease. And for quite a while, we have recognized the significance of promoting clinical trials in this disease as we try to advance treatment options for this disease. And based on my interest in pancreas cancer and clinical trials, I decided that it'll be helpful to organize how clinical trials are run at our institution. And that is how I was offered the opportunity to head this program.
That's so awesome. And how did you come to Medical College of Wisconsin specifically?
Oh, that's a long story. I don't know whether you want to hear the entirety of it. I grew up in India and went to med school there, came here to do some research in the cancer arena. I was on the West Coast at University of Southern California. And then training took me to various spots, including Ohio, Wisconsin, Houston, and then here as well. So it's a long story, a long road traveled, I think.
Yeah. Well, I'm based in Houston, so I guess you don't miss the humidity.
Yeah, you know, certainly, you know, there are days in February in Milwaukee when I think about the warmth of Houston. But then when summer comes, Wisconsin is so beautiful in summer.
That's what we hear. So before we get into the specifics of pancreatic cancer clinical trials, let's start off with clinical trials in general. For those that are unfamiliar, how would you describe what a clinical trial is?
You know, I think the simplest way to say this is that, you know, clinical trials is the bedrock of modern medicine. And no matter what area you are in, and it's even more important in cancer, where cure is so hard to come by, and we are constantly trying to advance treatments. The fundamental ideas that I think we need to keep in mind are, first, that, you know, before we run a clinical trial, we need to have a well-formed hypothesis. In the past, doctors treated patients based on empiric evidence or anecdotal evidence. And over time, people recognize that this is not a systematic or deliberate way to treat patients. And therefore, we said, let's have a hypothesis. And then ask the question, what kind of experiment can we design to prove that hypothesis and systematically go about it in a controlled fashion? Now, it is not enough to have a hypothesis and design an experiment. You also need to know how many patients or how many subjects need to be on that study to be able to reliably answer the question that you're asking. And if the study is done at different places, you need to make sure that there are uniform entry criteria so that the study that is done, if a study is run in Los Angeles and New York and Chicago, you want to be sure that the kind of subjects that are entering the study are gated so that you can compare reliably the results that happen with patients at all these places. So essentially, you need a hypothesis, you need a good design, you need conduct and oversight in a reliable fashion, and then get a result that gets systematically analyzed. And that'll help us move to the next step as to, you know, whether or not are we advancing science here? Are we advancing treatment? And broadly, you know, when you talk about clinical trials, the things that come to mind for most of us is, you use a drug, did that work or not? But clinical trials are way more than that. You know, it is not just looking at drugs that work or add to treatment. It is also about asking questions that can aid in the entire treatment program, whether that be doing a test, whether that be looking at circulating tumor DNA. That could be all kinds of things that are tested in the context of a clinical trial. But all of that, the key here is to remember that we are doing this in a systematic, deliberate, controlled fashion to be able to interpret the results and determine the results as either positive or negative, and then lead to the next study in that space as well.
Okay, and then I know you mentioned the oversight and the monitoring is so critical. We can touch on that a little bit more later as well, because I know that some people are interested in clinical trials because the monitoring is so great when you are a participant.
Yeah, you know, the monitoring, you know, I think the monitoring has two or three purposes, right? The first and foremost is that you want to make sure that the trial is conducted uniformly, reliably, methodically, no matter what center the studies run at. The second is that you want to make sure that this is done in an ethical fashion where patients are not compromised in any way. And third is that there is a data collection piece to it, and where data are collected at pre-specified intervals and reliably so that whatever results come out of that study can be interpreted in a reliable fashion. So certainly with clinical trials, there is more of an effort to rigorously monitor the conduct of the study. Therefore, there's probably a little bit more of oversight in terms of the frequency of doctor visits, blood draws, and so on and so forth. And I think ultimately it's a good thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what are the different kinds of clinical trials? I mean, we hear phase one, phase two, phase three. What do those terms mean?
Sure. You know, we can talk broadly about what those things mean. You know, again, important to recognize that, you know, it is the treatment clinical trials that are typically categorized into phase one, phase two, and phase three. Phase one clinical trials are very often the earliest kind of clinical trials, and phase three trials are what we call advanced clinical trials, where the drug has gone through a process of evolution and may be very close to a regulatory approval by, say, for example, the FDA, if you will. Also important to recognize that even before a drug goes into a phase one trial, there is a very long road. You know, there may be a molecule that is recognized in the laboratory to have some activity against cancer or any disease for that matter. But before you can take it into a clinical trial, there is a lot of work that needs to happen, sorting out the chemistry, sorting out the toxicity, sorting out how is it going to be absorbed into the body. All of that work has to be done, and a tremendous amount of data have to be submitted to the FDA to get the regulatory approval to be even able to run the study in the first place. And then you go to the phase one portion. Phase ones, again, can be a couple of different kinds. You could have the first in human kind of studies where you're testing out a drug to see whether it is safe for use in humans. And you're trying to identify what is the safest dose at which you can have activity. If it is in cancer, what is the safest and the highest dose at which you can have anti-cancer activity? Yeah. So that is what typically phase one trials do. But you could also look at phase one trials in combination. For example, there may be an existing treatment that is well known and approved. You may be adding a new compound to the existing combination. And there you're looking to find out at what dose can you add this new drug in a safe and efficacious manner to help the patient or to help treat the cancer, if you will. So phase one can be first in human where this is applied to someone who has not had luck or progress with any of the standard treatments where you're trying to find the safety of a drug, or you could apply it in combination with an existing combination to find the safe dose of the new drug that is being tested. Typically, once you go past phase one, you go to phase two, and phase two is where we are really looking at, now we know the dose at which it is safe to administer a drug, but now we want to know how effective is it. And these are run in slightly larger groups of patients, again, looking at whether the drug is showing anti-cancer activity or some sort of efficacy. Once we prove that the drug is efficacious or show some anti-cancer activity, then we move it into phase three. And phase three is where you're really asking the question, is this drug better than the existing standard of care or worse than the existing standard of care? And there you typically run randomized studies where you compare the new compound to the existing standard. And very often those are studies that are run before regulatory approval or FDA approval for the drug to be used in routine clinical practice.
Okay, so phase one, it's more safety focused, you would say. Phase two is more efficiency, you know, is this effective? And then phase three is where you really compare it to everyday treatment.
See, you said that in a much better fashion and in a much shorter way than my long-winded answer.
And then what about, is there a phase four?
Yeah, phase four, you know, it is somewhat of a, we don't typically run a lot of phase four studies at academic cancer centers. Phase four is mostly post-marketing. So for example, if a drug is FDA approved, you still want to collect data for long periods of time in patients who take the drug to make sure that there really aren't any untoward side effects that were noticed even during the phase three portion. But that, you know, that's mostly a post-marketing a program, phase four.
Okay, so that's why we don't hear about it as often.
Exactly.
Okay, so can you tell me a little bit more about what your office does with the clinical trial office?
Yeah, you know, it's really a central nodal point that coordinates clinical trial activity within a cancer center. So again, there are various kinds of clinical trials offices. What I direct here is the Cancer Clinical Trials Office. And we have various groups that work within the umbrella of the clinical trials office. So for us, you know, I would say we have about a little over 120 people working in the clinical trials office. There are people working with the regulatory aspect of the study. For example, when a study comes through, you want to make sure that there is a good informed consent form that is generated that we give the patients. That informed consent form needs to be reviewed by the institutional review board to make sure that it meets all the criteria. So the regulatory team works with the IRB, works with the sponsor of the study, works with the investigators. You know, there are research teams that help patients travel through the clinical trial process where patients are consented, their eligibility is determined, the side effects are monitored, there are data reporting groups within the clinical trials office. So there are various groups within the clinical trials office. Ultimately, the overarching idea is that that needs to be the central coordinating body that facilitates conduct of clinical trials right from inception to delivery to the patient and beyond.
Okay, so the oversight and monitoring, eligibility, all of that we touched on before, it really happens through the office?
Through the staff members in the clinical trials office, yes.
Okay, and what does a clinical trial coordinator do?
You know, again, the role is somewhat nebulous, but for the most part, most clinical trial coordinators are involved in identifying patients who are eligible for clinical trials. So for example, if I see a patient in clinic and feel that a clinical trial may benefit this particular patient, I would then call the clinical trials coordinator and say, hey, listen, I saw Mr. So-and-so in clinic. This patient may benefit from this trial. Then the coordinator looks through the patient's chart to see whether the patient meets criteria for trial participation. And if the patient meets criteria, then the coordinator meets with the patient, explains the study to the patient along with me, gives them a consent form, walks them through it. Once the patient signs consent, then they help coordinate the next steps so that the patient can go through the treatment on the clinical trial or whatever the clinical trial is investigating. So essentially, the clinical trial coordinator is the patient's best friend during their journey through the clinical trial so that they can navigate the process, if you will.
Okay. And then when do you usually recommend that a patient enrolls in a clinical trial, like from the time of diagnosis or?
You know, obviously, I am very biased here in a sense that we are an academic institution and we focus heavily on clinical trials. But I feel that, you know, if we are treating a disease where we don't have a cure, an overwhelming chance of cure, I think everyone needs to be treated on a clinical trial as much as possible. I think the central premise here is the idea that there is clinical equipoise when we decide clinical, when we conduct clinical trials, meaning every clinical trial that is offered to a patient at minimum would equal the standard of care. Right. So for example, if this is a patient who has been exposed to all the available treatments and there are no other treatment options available, there are some trials that we offer saying that, hey, listen, this trial may or may not benefit you as much, but being on the trial has a greater chance of working than not being on a trial. Yeah, so there is a clinical equipoise there. Or we might be saying, hey, the standard of care in this situation is drug combination X. We are adding drug Y to combination X to see whether adding that new drug is going to help improve your outcome. So there are various mechanisms in place at the level of scientific review committees, institutional review boards, of course, the FDA, to make sure that there is a clinical equipoise in that patients at minimum get the standard of care. And the question is whether are we adding more or not with the study. So to me, every patient who has cancer who is eligible for a clinical trial should try to participate in a study if available to them and if their provider recommends that for them, simply because not only does it have the potential to help that particular person, the patients of tomorrow benefit from the knowledge that we gain from treating these people as well.
And then you mentioned every patient receiving at minimum the standard of care. I think there's a lot of concern about placebo. So can we talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, the only situations where patients receive a placebo, again, very often these are randomized controlled trials. So for example, if we say that a patient is the standard of care in a certain situation would be a combination chemotherapy, and we are trying to ascertain whether adding a new compound to the standard chemotherapy is better or not. So that may be a situation where there is a randomized study where there is a group of patients who are getting the standard chemotherapy plus the experimental compound, and the other group may be just getting the standard chemotherapy plus a placebo. So in that situation, the patient is guaranteed to get the standard chemotherapy. Since the study is meant to determine whether adding that extra compound is helpful or not, I don't think the patient who is on the placebo group is compromised in any way because they're still getting the standard chemotherapy. So it is never the case that someone would be tricked into getting just the placebo, which is not beneficial to them. There'll always be clinical equipoise in that scenario.
Okay, so that's something that the patient wouldn't even need to worry about, that they'll always, even if they're in a clinical trial, they'll be getting at minimum the standard of care.
You know, and also important for people to remember that there are various regulatory bodies that govern the conduct of clinical trials. Every institution has, you know, there are departmental committees, there are scientific review committees, there are institutional review boards, and then there is the FDA, of course, which also has to. So all of these bodies very rigorously review a clinical trial before it is open for conduct to ensure that the highest standards are met and no one is compromised by being on the clinical trial.
That's a good point. And then another thing that I know that can be a hindrance is patients are concerned about cost and wonder if their insurance will be on board, or if participating in a clinical trial will be, their insurance will be against it.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think there are two ways in which you can categorize the expense associated with clinical trials. So, for example, if there is a standard treatment combined with an experimental agent that is administered, if the standard program is approved by insurance, that'll be paid for by the insurance. If the experimental compound is the one where there is a concern about the cost, and that is invariably covered by the study itself. That way, they don't have to pay anything out of pocket. More importantly, any test that is done on the clinical trial or and beyond what is considered standard is also paid for by the study. The area where it gets a bit nebulous is the second component, meaning there are some studies where patients will have to make extra trips to the hospital to have additional blood draws and what have you. The cost for those extra trips to the hospital, for example, that is very often not covered on a clinical trial simply because we don't want the trial to come across as incentivizing people to participate on a trial in a fashion that is not considered fair. But there are no hidden costs. What is covered and what is not covered is disclosed to patients right at the get-go. That way, they will not be in for a surprise of any kind while on the study.
Okay, that's good to know. And so I know we also wanted to discuss precision medicine. So can we start off just with a general definition of what precision medicine is?
Yeah, you already figured out that you don't get any short answers from me, and probably long-winded. In any case, I think in a nutshell, the idea is that patients are different, cancers are different, and you cannot realistically assume that the same treatment is going to work for all people with the same diagnosis. And precision medicine fundamentally comes down to the idea that you want to be able to identify features that are unique to a person's cancer or tumor or whatever disease that be, and then use a treatment that is personalized to that person's condition, whatever that may be. Ultimately, that is what it boils down to.
Okay, and so what about genotype versus phenotype? I know that that plays a part into it.
Yeah, a great question. Again, without getting too much into the weeds, when we talk about precision medicine, you could think about it in various formats, right? One is that, the treatment that we administer someone who is older and weaker may be different from someone who is younger and more robust. So that is more of phenotype. How does the person look in clinic? Can they handle a treatment? Yeah. However, if there are two people who are equally young and have the same diagnosis, we could try to be a little more precise. We may be able to look at, say, for example, if someone has a cancer, can we get some of the cancer cells and identify features unique to the cancer, whether that be at the level of the protein, at the gene, based on their scans, based on their blood work. So you may be able to identify characteristics unique to the tumor, a biologic footprint that may help then personalize the treatment. That is the genotype, looking at the gene of the cancer and then seeing and then identifying are there specific treatments that can be administered based on the genotype of the cancer. In the ideal world, you want to look at the phenotype and the genotype and then personalize treatment for people.
Okay, and then when you talk about the genotype and doing testing on the cancer cells, I mean, that's a type of genetic testing. We actually did an episode with Dr. Jenny Gertz, one of your colleagues. That was an incredible episode on genetic testing. If you didn't get a chance to listen to it, you guys should check it out. But this is different, right? Whenever you're testing specifically the cancer cells, it's not, you're testing the overall genetics of the person.
Yeah, great. And thank you for asking that question. That is so important to highlight that and establish that. So, you know, there are things that we are born with. We call that germline, yeah, that we get from our parents. And that is very different from what we call the somatic genome. The somatic genome is something that is acquired, if you will, meaning someone who develops colon cancer, for example, the cancer develops in the colon from the normal cells in the body. And why that person develops that cancer could be due to a whole host of reasons. It could be exposure, could be diet, could be all kinds of stuff. But ultimately, you know, there are things over and beyond what they were born with that led them to have cancer. And you identify that by studying the cancer or the tumor in great detail. So that is the somatic genome that we look at, as opposed to the germline, which is looking at the normal cells in your body that you were born with, identifying what are the genes or gene changes that you were born with that you inherited from your patients. So the somatic genome is equally important, if not more important, in treating cancer than the germline. But we do a combination of both to identify changes that may help determine treatment options for people with cancer.
Would you recommend that all patients get their tumors tested?
Absolutely. You know, I would strongly recommend that all patients get their tumors tested for various reasons. You know, I think depending on the kind of cancer that we are dealing with, it may be that we don't find something that we can work on, or we may not find an actionable target. Depending on the kind of cancers, in some cancers it may be 10-15%, in others it may be as high as 30-40% where we might find an actionable target. At the same time, it is important to systematically collect that data and store that data so that we can go back, mine that data, and then ask the question, can we correlate that data with the kind of treatment response patients obtained over time. So I think it is an amazing collection of data that can be utilized, not just to help the current patients, but future patients as well. Until we test, we don't know. So I think certainly I would strongly recommend all patients to have their tumor tested, particularly patients with advanced cancers, where you really don't run into insurance coverage issues for testing.
So it's not very standard for most patients to get their tumor tested. Is it something that you need to ask for?
Yes, it is. It is a little bit of a complicated space. There really isn't a great guidance on what has to be done for all kinds of cancers. Within the context of certain cancers, there are well-established guidelines in terms of who should get the germline testing, the testing that Dr. Gertz and you talked about,
right.
And also the somatic testing, which is the testing of the cancer genome or the tumor genome, if you will.
Right.
But I think a general rule of thumb is that in patients who have advanced cancers, you cannot go wrong with getting testing done. And there are minor variations between tumor types, stage, all of the above. But I think that's a good rule of thumb. Everyone with metastatic disease should have their tumor tested.
Okay. And when they're testing, I know this might be getting, like you said, in the weeds, but you're testing for circulating tumor DNA?
Yeah, you know, circulating tumor DNA is a different entity. When we do the testing, what we are routinely doing, well, most providers test the tumor specimen that's been biopsied or removed surgically to find out what are the genomic changes within the tumor itself. Circulating tumor DNA tests a different aspect. It looks at the fraction of tumor DNA that is shed into the circulation. Now, there are advantages and disadvantages that come with it. The obvious disadvantage is that as opposed to a tumor that is resected, where you have plenty of material to do the testing, when you identify circulating tumor DNA from the blood, the amount of material that you have to test is not as much. On the other hand, if you think about a tumor and you recognize that different areas of the tumor may have some heterogeneity, and the changes in one area of the tumor may not be mirrored exactly in another area of the tumor. Whereas if you're looking at the DNA that is circulating in the blood, one could argue that what you find in the circulation is a compilation or perhaps a more accurate reflection of the tumor in its entirety than biopsying one area of the tumor or testing one portion of the tumor. Circulating tumor DNA also has some inherent advantages in that this is something that is very non-invasive. So you can just draw blood and do the testing. You can do serial testing over time without causing too much discomfort to the patient. And therefore, you can see how the DNA profile is changing in circulation with treatment. Of course, the downside is that it is not yet ready for prime time, meaning how we utilize that information from testing circulating tumor DNA, that needs to be discussed very closely and very carefully with your provider, because there are a lot of areas where there are controversies there. So therefore, having that discussion, you know, I think patients hear about this new test and they want to do this, but at the same time, there are limitations to it as well. So very important that patients check with their providers as to what is appropriate in that given context. We also know that, you know, some tumors shed more into the circulation, some others don't. Based on the location of the tumor, you may not find as much circulating tumor DNA. So there are various areas that are gray that merits the discussion with the provider, I would say.
So would you say that this this area of testing, it's still new and it's
it is somewhat new compared to tumor-based testing, and it's a rapidly evolving area. I think that's an area that is being studied and closely observed by clinicians across the world, looking at how can we leverage this information to help our patients. So again, I would say that having awareness of the possibility to do circulating tumor DNA-based testing is important, but whether that is applicable to a given patient, I think that is something that the patient needs to discuss with their provider so that it can be interpreted in the context of where they are in their treatment. Yeah.
Okay. So not something that you would necessarily recommend every patient do?
I think so. I don't think we are there just yet.
Okay. All right. So on the topic of new treatments and therapies, are there any other therapies on the horizon that you've seen that are exciting to you?
You know, I think, you know, there are so many new compounds and drugs that are getting tested in various different cancers that it is probably not within really the scope of our podcast to go over all of those. At the same time, I think it is important to recognize that we are at a unique time in cancer therapeutics where, you know, we have, you know, there was a period where we did not have the ability to study the cancer genome in as much detail. There was also a period where the computational tools available to curate that data and interpret it reliably was also not available. Now we are at a point where we have the ability to study the cancer gene or the genome or the transcriptome, however you choose to call it, in great detail, interpret it in a very robust fashion, and then design robust trials directed against the alterations that we find. And there are various aspects of the genome that are studied in various contexts, looking at the efficacy of drugs, assessing the toxicity of drugs, looking at how effective immunotherapy can be, how can we modify the benefit of immunotherapy. So I would say personalization of cancer treatment is being explored in all areas pertinent to cancer therapies. And I think we are in that unique situation where we can take it to the next level with all the available tools at our disposal.
Yeah, there's definitely, I mean, I'm sure that you've seen in your time in this clinical trials and in medicine, just a vast expansion.
Oh, the changes that we have seen over the last decade is just amazing. And I think that the change is accelerating. You know, so I think what we saw in the last 10 years, we might see in the next 2 years. So I think it is an exciting time for patients and cancer researchers across the world. Yeah.
Well, we are certainly very passionate about what you do. So just wanted to say thank you for all the hard work that you do. Everything that we do here at Cena Magwitz Foundation, all our funding goes directly to clinical trials. So it's something that we believe in with all our hearts. So we appreciate you.
Thank you for having me on this show. And thank you for everything that you do as well in terms of the help and support that you provide our patients.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and hopefully we can have you back soon.
Likewise. Yeah, thank you.